And now, in keeping with our opening hymn, Brother Jim's selected subject is Lessons for the Last Day, or What in the World is Going On? Lessons for the Last Day, or What in the World is Going On? Brother Jim.
Thank you, Brother Tom. I'd like to bring the love of the brethren in the small class in Covina, California, and from the Los Angeles brethren as well. And Teresa and I are glad to bring ours in person. Well, now our subject is Lessons for the Last Day. And what do we mean by the last day? Well, I think we'll just mention, we look at Joshua at Jericho. And it's, how many days did they circle around the city?
Seven,
that's right. And once each day, except how many times in the last day? That's right, good. And now, the army marches around, and somebody marches around with them. Does anybody remember who marches around with the army? The priests. How many were there?
Seven,
that's right. And each one of them is given a trumpet. So how many trumpets? Yeah, you're guessing real good today. Almost any question, if you answer seven, you'll probably be right. But we start with Joshua rose early, and that's on the first day, corresponding to Jesus' resurrection. And then we get down to the last day, which starts with, and they rose early. Oh, what does that mean? Well, okay, we've got the resurrection of the sleeping saints at the beginning of the last day. But now, we're not so much interested in Joshua at Jericho and how it helps us to identify these seven trumpets of revelation spanning the gospel age, or the seven messengers of the seven churches doing the same. But rather, we're more interested today in the last chapters of Ezekiel, and also what they mean to you and to me, what lessons we can get out of it, especially how we should change ourselves. In considering the Gog and Magog chapters, which we will get to eventually, it covers the political situation. So we're going to talk a little bit about politics, not something that I would generally talk about. A definition of politics has been given as, it's a battle for power masquerading as a struggle over principles. And in centuries past, we've had the right wing. More recently, we've had the left wing. And new to most of us is the rise of Islam. Now, the right wing ruled from the Vatican and or from Westminster for a good many centuries. And people discuss whether or not Bloody Mary was worse than Queen Elizabeth, because Bloody Mary, a Catholic, murdered Protestants at a faster rate than Elizabeth. And Queen Elizabeth murdered more because she lived longer and reigned longer. No Protestant was allowed to have anything to do with the translation of the King James Version. So how did it become the King James Bible? That's another question. Now let's fast forward to the Gospel Age harvest. In the Gospel Age harvest, God is not protecting sectarianism anymore. If ever he really was, he certainly is not at the present time. Lesson number one for us. We are called to come out of sectarianism. Come out of Babylon, my people, that ye have nothing to do with her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues, is the essence of Revelation 18:4. Now, we see in the present time two groups trying to destroy what's called Christianity. Leftism and Islam are both intent on destroying Christianity. We can see that. We don't like the acts of either group attempting to do it. But lesson for us, we are not by them to be driven into supporting sectarianism in any of its forms. And that may be true if we become tempted to become the non-denominational denomination of Bible students. We are not to be driven into supporting sectarianism. Lesson number two. We must have nothing to do with getting on the growing anti-Jewish, anti-Israel bandwagon. Have we noticed it growing? Leftism and Islam are both anti-Israel, and on top of that, Islam is inherently against all Jews. I remember reading some years ago that it is in one of the Islamic holy writings that Allah's kingdom can begin only after every last Jew in the world has been killed. So, we are to have nothing to do with anti-Israel, anti-Jewish sentiments as they grow during our time in the last day. Okay, so that's two things that we should not do. There ought to be something that we should do. So that gets us to point number three. We must learn to have love even for our enemies. And why? We must learn to love our enemies now if we are going to bless them in Christ's kingdom. Now, just reviewing a little bit of history. The law of Moses was given way back when for a purpose. It was to convince people of their sinfulness. Does it do a good job of that? Now, if people don't want to be convicted of sin, then generally speaking, they won't want to have anything to do with law. And if not with law, then with the lawgiver. Consider the attraction of Islam. Muhammad said, "No man can change his character." Well, if that were true, it would absolve people from any responsibility from having to try. I think we all know from personal experience, if we have to choose between changing ourselves and changing everybody else, we'd much rather change everybody else because it's a lot easier than changing self. Now, under Islam, whatever you do, it's not your fault. You can't help it. That's your character, even if you must pay the penalty for it. Now, what is the attraction of leftism, which some have described as the fastest growing religion in America? The idea is boost people's self-esteem and things will get better. That's sort of a code word for saying pride is a good thing. Now, if there is no God, then there is no morality. If there's no morality, there is no sin. Now, what happens if you say, yes, there is a law, there is morality, then you are called bigoted, prejudiced against, and then you get to fill in the blank, or they get to fill in the blank, and you are dismissed. I remember years ago somebody said, "What's a sociologist?" The answer given was, A sociologist is someone who blames everybody except the guy who committed the crime. So whatever you do, it cannot possibly be your fault. That is an attraction in leftism. The only sin, then, is opposing leftism. Neither Muslims nor leftists are willing to listen to contrary evidence. To the Muslim, contrary evidence is a forgery. To the leftist, it's lies, all lies. Those are the usual defenses of error against truth. Both are emotion-based. Fact will not matter. And some churches are too, unfortunately. Defectors are enemies. From leftism, it is punishable by vilification. From Islam, it is punishable by death. Now, both Islam and leftism need an enemy, an outside enemy, and that's to quell internal rebellion. No matter how bad I, as the boss, am, if I've got a worse foreign enemy, I get to justify myself. Turn your wrath away from me and to him, whoever him may be. To Islam, the enemy is all non-Muslims, the infidels, and especially Jews and Christians. To leftism, the enemy is Christians and Judaists. Not all Jews, because a good many Jews support the leftist agendas. Not with just thousands or even millions, but sometimes even billions. Currently, leftism and Islam are making an uneasy peace with each other in order to destroy Christianity and Judaism. Is it any secret who is behind both? But sometimes there is a consolation prize, a silver lining in the dark cloud. Have we noticed that hostility between Christians and Jews is being broken down? The hostility between Jews and Christians is being broken down as a preparation for Christ's kingdom. Now we go back to the law that God gave to Moses. Exodus 19th chapter tells us, the Israelites heard the law and they said, all that Jehovah hath spoken we will do. In Deuteronomy 28, if thou wilt not observe to do all the words of this law, Jehovah will scatter thee among all peoples, from the one end of the earth, even unto the other end of the earth. That was perhaps typically fulfilled at the time of the Babylonian captivity. But it wasn't quite from one end of the earth to the other. But we know that came later. Deuteronomy 30 gives hope, nevertheless. When all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse, thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations whither Jehovah thy God hath driven thee. Then Jehovah thy God will return and gather thee from all the peoples whither Jehovah thy God hath scattered thee. Fast forward now down to Jesus' time. At the end, Matthew 27, verses 24 and 25. When Pilate washed his hands, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this righteous man. See ye to it. And all the people answered and said, His blood be on us and on our children. Unfortunately for them and their children, the Lord heard that. John 1st chapter, 10 through 12. The world was made through him, and the world knew him not. He came unto his own, and they that were his own received him not. But as many as received him, to them gave he the right to become the children of God, even to them that believe on his name. And as to the rest, remember how it was the high priest Joseph Caiaphas who said, Isn't it expedient that one man die for the nation? 40 years later, within 40 years, the temple was destroyed. The priesthood, the Sadducees, were the ones who ruled the temple worship. In A.D. 70, the temple was destroyed. There was now nothing more for the priesthood to do. Forty years from the beginning of Jesus' ministry, when he was baptized, brought us to the destruction of the temple. 40 years from his crucifixion brought us to A.D. 73 and the last Jewish group holding out at Masada was destroyed. 40 years in each case. But there is hope, and the hope is found in the book of Ezekiel. We have chapters 37 to the end. Ezekiel 37 is the Valley of Dry Bones. I will suggest that this began to have its fulfillment in things that happened from 1873 to 1878. I hadn't really thought to go into the detail as to what was happening up to October of 1878, but maybe I'll take just a moment. It may be of some interest. In 1873, I think it was the month of May, that there was a stock market crash in Vienna, Austria, which shook Europe. About 4 months later, in September, just 2 days before the beginning of the Jewish New Year, there was a stock market crash in New York. And this began what we call now the Long Depression. At the time, they called it the Great Depression. And that lasted until the 1930s, when they decided, this is now something to be called the Great Depression. The other one was the Long Depression. And yes, I'm aware that there are some economists that say there never was a Long Depression. They never taught it to me in school. But it's easy enough to go on the Internet under either Christian Revolt or Long Depression to find a depression from the 1870s, 1873, into the 1890s. Now, that of itself didn't bring Israel back to its land. But the following fall, in the fall planting of 1874 through the spring harvest of 1875, in the Balkan Peninsula, it was a disaster. It was sufficient that the farmers, many of them Christian, whether Roman or Eastern Orthodox, just had nothing to pay their taxes with. Now, Islam at the time gave a certain tax to the Muslims, but to non-Muslims, they had to pay two or three times as much tax. That was their penalty for not being Islamic. And they had nothing with which to pay. So, rather short-sightedly, the Ottomans went, took everything they could find, furniture, food, anything, leaving them nothing. And this sparked what was called the Christian Revolt about mid-year 1875. In October of that year, 1875, things were so bad that the Ottoman Empire declared bankruptcy, refusing to repay its debts to the nations and peoples of Europe. Certainly didn't earn them any friends that way, did it? It turned the Christians and the Muslims into mortal enemies. There was a Christian revolt then, and it was brutally suppressed by the Ottomans. And the next year, I think it was Serbia and Montenegro revolted from the Ottoman Empire, and they were brutally suppressed. And when we get to 1877, the Russians realized that their interests in the Balkan Peninsula were being completely taken away by the Ottoman Empire. But they couldn't afford to go to war. But then they could afford even less not to. And by February of 1878, they were on the doorstep of Constantinople, the capital of the empire, of the Ottoman Empire. They had already taken Adrianople, just 100 miles away. So they sued for peace, and there was something they called the Treaty of San Stefano, which granted Russia complete dominance in the Balkan Peninsula. That was hardly acceptable to the rest of Europe. And so they convoked a Congress of Nations in Berlin to arbitrate the matter. And as we know, there was a fellow, a Jewish fellow, and the Jews were not eligible to be prime ministers of England. So how did that happen, that Disraeli became prime minister? Goes way back to somewhere around 1815, thereabouts, that Disraeli's father, who was also named Disraeli, got in a big fight with the local synagogue. And he was so mad about it that he had his sons baptized in the Anglican Church. So in 1868, Disraeli was elected prime minister, and he lasted for less than a year. And Gladstone came in. And Gladstone botched it, too. So at least Disraeli had learned some lessons from the year that he was in power. And when he came in 1874 and lasted 1881, then he knew how to conduct things better. England needed an ally to maintain the empire. They needed an ally in the eastern end of the Mediterranean, and that had to be the Ottoman Empire. So here comes Disraeli to the Congress of Nations, and he could tell the Ottomans, look, you guys are broke. You need money. I think we can find you some buyers here for some of that no good land in Palestine. And so the first new Jewish community was reestablished in Palestine in October of 1878. I thought perhaps that might be of slight interest because I never knew what led up to the return in Petah Tikva and some of the other communities. It was like just about one a month that a new community was reestablished there. Someone may say, but Petah Tikva didn't last. Malaria killed them off or drove them away. Yes, and then they came in with pesticides to get rid of the mosquitoes, and Petah Tikva today is way over 100,000 population. So it really did get started. Now, in Ezekiel 37, the Valley of Dry Bones, there were two prophesyings. The first one was when the bones were coming together, and then sinews came upon the bones, and flesh upon the sinews, and skin upon the flesh. Now, these, I think, must be stages, all right. I'll offer a suggestion, and perhaps someone can offer a better suggestion, which will be fine. That the bones coming together would suggest the return of Jews to their land in individual communities here and there. We come up to the sinews or the tendons, the connections. And with the Arab opposition that ultimately developed, they needed defense forces, the Haganah. The flesh comes up. Well, that's indicating something closer to life. And that was and thereafter, a growing economy. And then finally, skin, that suggests boundaries or the independence in 1948. But still, Ezekiel says, the Lord said, prophesy again. And the prophesying the second time was for the breath or the spirit. And so we may prophesy that it is coming, but not yet does Israel have the Spirit. It will when we see the resurrection of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Moses and David and Daniel and all the other ancient worthies, then they will have the Spirit of the Lord. Now we come to Ezekiel chapters 38 and 9. We have a number of nations listed, and sometimes we may read them, and they're not very obvious, because we don't use all of these names currently. But we start out with Gog of the land of Magog. Where do we get the thought as to who Gog really is? Some people have said Gog is Russia. Some have said, especially Baptists in Russia, say that it's the Chinese. And there are other thoughts that have been offered from time to time. But let's look and see if we can't find some background for it. Now, the Lamza translation isn't exactly a terribly reliable translation, but we'll notice that they translate Magog as Mongol. And to a degree, I think that is correct. Now, the word Gog, what does it mean? Where did it come from? In Hebrew, a Gog is a roof. Now, there's a verb form of the word, sagab, which means to lift up. So, the roof is that which is lifted up. The group that we call Gog or Magog is what the Eastern languages call Saka. And the people who do work in languages can actually trace the relationship between the word Saka and Gog. The Yakut tribe in eastern Siberia still call themselves not Yakut, but Saka, Saka. Perhaps I shouldn't take too long in going through the details here, but Magog is related to Gog. Gog is the elevated. And Magog, well, in Hebrew, if you prefix an M, it means not going towards, but going out from, away from. And so if you have Gog, you have the capital, the elevated people. And Magog, those are the people that go out from them. It's the greater Gog tribe. The groups that you can classify under Magog today are most numerous, the Great Russians, then the Mongols. When the Mongols went down into India, we call them the Mughals. the Uzbekis, the Kazakhs, there you have that name Sakha preserved, Ka-Sakha. The Koreans, who trace their history as coming out of Mongolia, again, the Yakut call themselves Sakha. The Eskimos and the Aleuts in Alaska, the Samoyeds in northern Russia, maybe even the Picts in Scotland, probably the eastern Scotland, more associated with Edinburgh. These are at the head of the Eastern Bloc, Gog of the land of Magog. Now, the various translations as to whether Gog is the prince of Rosh or chief prince of the tribe and the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. So who are Meshach and Tubal? Without going into detail on Meshach, it's Armenia. And Tubal, we don't call them Tubal over here. We call them Georgians. It has nothing to do with Atlanta. But a group on the south side of the Caucasus Mountains. The Slavic tribes call them Grusians. They call themselves Kartvelians, the Kara of Tubal, the rocks or mountains of Tubal, which are to the north of them. The capital today is Tbilisi. The Georgian word Tbili means warm, and there are hot springs around the capital, Tbilisi. And Tbilisi then is also related then to our word Tubal in Genesis 10. Now, these two tribes, like the great Russians, have a history in Eastern Orthodox Christianity. The Armenians and the Georgians are completely surrounded by Turkic tribes who want Muslims who want to exterminate them. So you can see why there is a certain bond between Armenia and Georgia with the great Russians, whose history also is in the Eastern Orthodox tradition. Now we come to the next one, Persia or Iran. Where does the name Persia come from? Oh, do you remember back in Daniel, Mina Tekel Upharsin? And the Mina was described and the Tekel was described. And Paris means divisions. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. So the Persians were a division of the tribe of the Madai or Medes, and that's why they remain to a degree united against their foreign enemies. Now we go back to the great Russians and the related ones of the tribe of Magog. There was a time when Cyrus, king of Persia, was conquering to the east and the west and the north and the south. And it just seemed that nobody could stop them. The tribe that stopped them was to the north, the Russians, the tribe of the Massageti. And that can be looked up in history. From that time, back before 500 BC, until the 20th century, the great Russians and the Persians were at loggerheads. They hated each other. They feared each other. They wanted nothing to do with each other until the fall of the Shah. And that is during the lifetime of most of us in this room. This is the first time that you can see your way through to the fulfillment of Ezekiel 38. Our grandparents could not see it in their time because the Persians, the Iranians, had nothing to do with the great Russians. Next tribe listed is Cush. Cush is still the name given to the country in Africa called Ethiopia, as we do it, but includes more than that. It's all of Black Africa. The exceptions would be Egypt and North Africa and the southernmost part of Africa. That would be Ophir. Remember the golden wedge of Ophir? And South Africa is one of the two major gold supplies in the world. Solomon's ships went there first to collect the gold. The next tribe listed is Put, which is North Africa. That would be the Berbers and the Tuareg. Today they call themselves Arabs because the Arabs were their rulers. But they are separate from the Egyptians and from the Arabs of Arabia. Then we have Gomer and all his hordes. Gomer was divided into Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togarma. That's, again, Genesis 10. Ashkenaz, we get our word Skanza or Scandinavia from that. The Jews that dwelt in the North German plain, they still call themselves Ashkenazim today. And Riphath, we speak of the Carpathian Mountains, which were the original homeland of the Slavic tribes. And the derivation of the name, the Kara Riphath. Kara. We have that in English in two forms. Kara, preserved through the Germanic languages as hard, a characteristic of rock. And through the Celtic languages, like the cairns of Australia, piles of rocks, that's where it comes from. The Kara Riphath, or the rocks of Riphath, the mountains of Riphath, the mountains from which the Slavic tribes came. And we come to the third one, Togarma. And the house of Togarma is mentioned separately. In the Greek Septuagint, they call it Thergama, from which we get our word Turk. The Tokharian language survived in what we call northwestern China until the 9th century AD. So it's not difficult to identify the house of Togarma with the Turkic peoples. And they're not exclusive to what country we call Turkey today, because part of them are still in what we call Soviet Central Asia, and that's why we had Turkmen SSR or Turkestan. That's part of it. Okay, this identifies for us the Eastern Bloc. Now let's drop down a little bit to verse 13 to see about the Western Bloc. Verse 13 gives us first Sheba and Dedan. Well, that's Arabia. In Genesis 10 and in Genesis 25, we find that Sheba and Dedan are in two genealogies. They are in the genealogy of Abraham, that's in the 25th chapter, and they are also in the genealogy of Cush. We find this most notable where you've got the darkest of the Arab population in the Yemen, in the southwestern part of Arabia. In fact, if you look at the satellite maps, it's hard to find any green in Arabia except in that southwest corner, which we call the Yemen today. So Sheba and Dedan are Arabia. Then we have the merchants of Tarshish. Well, that's Western Europe. We'll get into that in a moment as to why. With the young lions thereof, that would be the Americas, Australia, and New Zealand, perhaps. The merchants of Tarshish. Tarshish, those are people that came out of Greece, according to Genesis 10. Even in Ireland, they have the legend that they came from Greece originally. Southwestern part of Spain was known as Tartessus. When they established a colony on the eastern Mediterranean, the northeastern corner of the Mediterranean, it was called Tarshish or Tarsus. Hence, we had Saul of Tarsus. Tarshish brought four things. I think this is in Ezekiel 27:12. I'll look quickly and see if I got it right this time. Yes, Ezekiel 27:12. Tarshish was thy merchant by reason of the multitude of all kinds of riches, with silver, iron, tin, and lead. They traded for thy wares. I mentioned that southwestern Spain was called Tartessus. Now, from the Spanish peninsula, there is an abundant supply of silver, of iron. We also see that in the iron mines of France. And lead. Lead came out of Spain in those days. But tin, we don't find it there. Very little tin is found in Europe or anywhere west of the of Israel, except one place. And that's southwestern England, Cornwall. The British had the world's supply of tin. Hence, it was the British who invented the tin canister, which we abbreviate to tin can today. Now, Spain, western France, and the British Isles, they were the Celtic countries, or Celtic countries, if you prefer. That's the Tarshish from Genesis 10. So here we see the Western bloc with the merchants of Tarshish and their former colonies, the young lions, the newer ones thereof, which would be the Americas, and perhaps Australia and New Zealand. I won't be sure on that. But perhaps of greater interest to us is Sheba and Dedan are mentioned first. I've been aware of that for over 40 years, maybe 50. That Arabia is to be at the head of the Western Bloc. I struggled with that for decades, that it must be in some way that it would appear to be calling the shots, like perhaps they did during the Gulf War. But I think now we see that in the political situation, they are the oil supplier. And have you noticed what the price of gasoline is these days? Where's the money going to? Just a little aside. In the earlier 1800s, there was an economist and historian by the name of Alexis de Tocqueville. And he sort of ridiculed the idea of democracy. He said, democracy can exist only for as long as it takes the populace to find they can vote themselves largest from the public treasuries. Are we there? He also said the time would come when the Congress will bribe the people with their own money. In more recent years, we find that they've gone one beyond that. The Congress has been bribing the people with the money borrowed from China and Arabia. Another way to say that is selling the country to China and Arabia. Now, there is a consolation prize in that. If at the head of the Eastern Bloc we have the great Russians and their allies, and at the head of the Western Bloc we have Arabia, Muslim Arabia, it will be leftism versus Islam that brings about Armageddon. So it should not be possible to blame Christ for Armageddon. That is our consolation prize. But, you know, we could be left a little discouraged if we simply let the matter fall right there. There is hope, and that's in the last 9 chapters of Ezekiel, 40 through 48. It's the picture of Ezekiel's temple. So our message to the world is, the kingdom will come. That kingdom for which we have been taught to pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Now, all this could just be intellectualism that does nothing really to change us for the better. So let's consider, what are the lessons for us, for you and for me? Ezekiel 7:19. Their silver and their gold shall not be able to deliver them. I'll tell you what I expect, and I'm not going to pin my Christian life on it, but I'll tell you what I expect. I expect from what I read in the scriptures, types such as the Exodus and the plagues, I expect there will be a sudden inflation, then economic collapse. So like it says in James, the 5th chapter, we should not put our hope in dollars or pounds or lira or any other form of money. Now, the logical thing for us to do, there's 2 of them. For you and for me, the lesson is, get out of debt and stay out of debt. We should not allow that we will be unable to repay our debtors, not for saving our own hides, but that Christ be not blamed. You can just imagine somebody saying, I could have gotten through that deep depression if it weren't for that blankety-blank Bible student who refused to repay me. So I think the best course for us is to get out of debt and stay out of debt. From Isaiah 28, especially verses 15 through 17, it speaks of the refuge of lies. Any question about that and what's going on in government today? Last evening, a brother was telling us about what's going on in the Detroit area, or has been going on in the Detroit area, and it's not limited to Detroit by any means, nor is it limited to America. We've heard of the big lie technique going back 80 years. We're seeing it in this country now. For us, the lesson should be, tell the truth and tell only the truth. If for any reason you can't tell the truth, don't say anything. Tell only the truth. And tell the people, and tell one another, remind one another, encourage one another, that resurrection is the one and only hope. It is the one great hope, resurrection. There's nothing that any man can do to keep you out of the resurrection. There are things that we should not do. 2 Timothy 1:7. God has not given us the spirit of fear. If we have the spirit of fear, then who did give it to us? It didn't come from God. God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of discipline, self-discipline. If we do not exercise self-discipline, we will be candidates for the rightists, for the leftists, or the Islamicists. We must learn to control self. We are not to endorse hellfire eternally. That only gives us a mental excuse for not learning to love our enemies, as we have been commanded to learn to love our enemies. Because I can always justify myself, if I believe in eternal torture, by saying, whatever I did to that so-and-so, it ain't nothing to what God is going to do to him. So I'm giving him a break no matter what I do to him. Have nothing to do with the eternal torture doctrine. And one more thing. Let's have nothing to do with you must join us to be saved, no matter how one defines the us. Because if Christ died once for all, then should not all benefit? When I see him moving around there, it gives me the willies. You're the chairman. Aren't you supposed to be in your chair? Okay. So let's learn to love our enemies. Consider, how do you want to be remembered? Do you want to be remembered for what you did for people or to them? That's what we're working on today. The matter is well illustrated by a poem from over 100 years ago, Sermons We See by Edgar Guest. I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. I'd rather one should walk with me than merely tell the way. The eye's a better pupil and more willing than the ear. Fine counsel is confusing, but example's always clear. And the best of all the preachers are the men who live their creeds, for to see good put in action is what everybody needs. I soon can learn to do it if you let me see it done. I can watch your hands in action, but your tongue too fast may run. And the lecture you deliver may be very wise and true, but I'd rather get my lessons by observing what you do. For I might misunderstand you and the high advice you give, but there's no misunderstanding how you act and how you live. When I see a deed of kindness, I am eager to be kind. When a weaker brother stumbles and a strong man stays behind. Just to see if he can help him, then the wish grows strong in me to become as big and thoughtful as I know that friend to be. And all travelers can witness that the best of guides today is not the one who tells them, but the one who shows the way. One good man teaches many men to believe what they behold. One deed of kindness noticed is worth 40 that are told. Who stands with men of honor learns to hold his honor dear. For right living speaks a language which to everyone is clear. Though an able speaker charms me with his eloquence, I say, I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day.